you know, listen, the radical right did not wait for the Republican Party to do what they wanted. They formed organizations apart from the Republican Party, and they eventually took it over. And I think that more Americans would prefer to live in a democracy if they fully understood what it delivers than kleptocratic autocracy with authoritarian and theocratic features. The right, when they lost in 2020, they didn't roll over. They did things we would never want to do, like spread lies and incite political violence at the Capitol. We wouldn't want to do that, but they also got out their base and they went after low propensity voters.
Hey folks, Michael Steele here. This is going to be a very special conversation today because it opens up some insights into narratives that we see playing out across the country, Trump administration, out of the Project 2025 sphere, some of the folks inside the various efforts to undermine our democracy and to establish a theocracy, a kleptocracy, an authoritarian regime, all of those pieces. So Catherine Stewart has been covering religious nationalism and the assault on American democracy for 16 years now. She is the author of the very important book, The Power Worshippers: Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism, the award-winning book upon which the documentary feature God and Country was produced by Rob Reiner and Michelle Reiner is based. Her 2012 book, The Good News Club, covered the religious rights effort to infiltrate and undermine public education. We see those storylines continuing to play out. And in her latest book, Money, Lies, and God: Inside the Movement to Destroy American Democracy, she lays out in greater detail the roles that are played by various groups within the anti-democratic movement, the funders, the thinkers, the sergeants, the infantry, and the power players. We get into what each of those groups represent and how they individually and collectively contribute to the overall anti-democratic movement that we see playing out. It's real-time conversation about real-time events. So you want to sit back, maybe grab an adult beverage or two, and enjoy this conversation with Catherine Stewart about the money, lies, and God that's playing out in our democracy right now. We'll get into it right after this quick break. Hey, everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. Look, it's crazy out there, and we're all kind of looking for anchors and trying to process what's happening. There are various aspects of this environment that we're in that I've tried to peel back the curtains on a little bit. We've talked about the culture, and then we'll be having more conversations on that. We've now opened the door into the sort of faith component, which I think is a very, very important part of this conversation, because I think it's more of a driver than some people may realize. And to help us kind of walk through that, I'm really excited to have Catherine Stewart with us today because she has written some really strong stuff. You may remember her from her book, The Power Worshippers: Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. Well, she's got a new one out, which we're going to get into, which dovetails obviously very nicely. And as we were talking before we started recording, you know, the fact that she's got to have this conversation, you know, and her new book, Money, Lies, and God: Inside the Movement to Destroy American Democracy. It is out now. We're going to get into it with Catherine Stewart. Welcome, Catherine.
It's great to be in conversation with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Look, this, I asked you about, how the book was going, and you were kind of like, you know, it's just frustrating that we actually have to have this conversation, you know, in so many ways. I want to actually go back before we get to this book, because in The Power Worshippers, the rise of religious nationalism is the scene setter for the unraveling of democracy. So connect the dots, if you would, from Power Worshippers to this new book about God, about the movement to destroy American democracy through money, lies, and God?
Thank you. That's a great question. You know, this is a movement that has been exploiting religion for politics and power for quite some time. The movement is as strong as it is because of decades of investment of the in its infrastructure, the movement. It's a leadership-driven movement. And they promote this idea, an anti-democratic idea, frankly, the idea that the United States is founded not on any principles, the principles of equality and pluralism, mm-hmm. and justice and rule of law, but on the idea of a specific religion and cultural heritage. It's the idea also that America is on the brink of an apocalypse because of the rise of equality and what mm-hmm. they call wokeness, which happens to be a bucket they throw anything into that they don't.
Right, right.
You know, the idea that anybody remotely to the left of them, including what they call rhinos or
Republicans in name only,
those are that they comprise the radical left. And they have this idea that democracy won't be able to solve the problems that we face. And so the rules really don't apply anymore. And what we need is a strong man, a sort of more authoritarian leader who's going to put himself above the law and break the rules, break the norms, is what we're seeing in our government now, and who's going to basically seize the reins of power and scrap the rules of law in favor of the iron fist. So it's sort of the idea that democracy, in the sense of a government, is representative of the people, mm-hmm. and respecting individual rights in a pluralistic society, the idea that this kind of government simply doesn't work. So you need to smash it up and create a more autocratic form of government.
But wait a minute, wait a minute. Does anybody read a history book? I know we have shortchanged public education in this country, but people can't be that damn dumb. Well, to think that there aren't enough examples in history to show that whenever you go to the guy who tells you, I alone can fix it, I'm your retribution, make me a dictator, but only for one day, that issue is going to work out well for anybody. Because all of those folks have ended up in not really good situations when the public finally realizes, oh, you're full of crap.
It's true, but sometimes it takes a while. Listen, I think misinformation or disinformation is a massive problem, right?
Right.
We just have to acknowledge there's been a terrific amount of disinformation out there targeting the rank and file. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that this is a movement that exploits identity politics. They always accuse the left of playing identity politics, but to be honest, I think they play it harder. You're with us, you're against us. You're one of the pure or the impure. You're a kind of a true, proper American, one who believes correctly and more importantly, votes correctly. Or you're, in many of the spaces that I go to in the course of my research, they call anyone who's not on board with their agenda demonic or satanic. This is where a lot of the exploitation of religion comes in, because, you know, I think many, if not most, American Christians actually think their religion has to do with loving their neighbors and think for the common good.
My reading of scripture, I don't remember anywhere in which Christ said to the people in the community or his disciples that I alone can fix it. You know what I'm saying? In the sense that he tried to help us recognize the power we have within us through this little thing called loving thy neighbor is how you fix it. And so coming to him was a way of exposing yourself to that truth about your humanity, because that can sometimes get lost in the things that man create. And so, you know, when you wanted to get to the Father, you had to come through him through love, right? That was the whole gospel. And yet, you know, these folks out here castigating people who don't look like them, love like them, live like them, as being less godly, less the children of God, seems antithetical to everything that Christ taught, which is why I have such a problem with the whole Christian nationalism, far-right evangelicalism, which is, in my view, just a bunch of bullshit that distort scripture no differently than those in the Islamic world who distort the teaching of Islam, because they have a political agenda they're trying to fulfill, and they're using religion as a cudgel against the people.
That's absolutely true. And they're also taking aim at Christian leaders who do not, and Christians who do not go along with the agenda. They call them sort of woke Christians or fake Christians. And in fact, there are a lot of Christian leaders who are forming groups sort of opposed to this agenda. I think about groups like the Baptist Joint Committee, Christians Against Christian Nationalism Network, which is more on the Catholic side, and so many others. But these folks are often called heretics. You know, some of them write books against what they call woke Jesus. One leader said, I've made it my mission to eradicate wokeism from the American pulpit.
Well, yeah. I mean, I nearly fell out. No, actually, I did. I had to sit down when I read the article. I think it was in Newsweek that reported some evangelical preacher castigating Jesus as being too woke. And I'm like, oh, you mean the Beatitudes? I mean, you know, when you've done for the least of these, you've done for me. I mean, that's where we come. So let's bring it to the book, Money, Lies, and God. How do money, lies, and God translate or play a role in America's democratic decline in what you set out in the book?
Right. Well, thanks. So money, of course, because money is a huge piece of the story. In the last decades, we've had huge concentrations of wealth accruing to those at the tippy top of the economic ladder. And that's destabilized the political system in some interesting ways. You mm-hmm. have a lot of folks, sort of members of the rank and file, who feel like legitimately that life is harder for them. And they have, you know, they look at their parents and they say, well, my dad could buy a house on a single salary. Mom could stay home when the kids were little. Things seemed to be easier for them. The public schools were functioning better, and things, why are things so much harder for me? The rights of the workforce have been eroded, and they have these legitimate grievances. And to be honest, it fosters mistrust in the system. It fosters mistrust in the whole idea that a democracy can work. And so they're more likely to put their faith in the guy who comes alone and says, I can fix it. So second, lies or conscious disinformation is another huge feature of this movement. The lies have to do, you know, by the way, with the idea of waste in government. We're seeing this right now. There's just been this massive propaganda campaign about waste and fraud in government. So the DOGE people are just trying to smash it all up. But, you know, and of course there's waste in government and fraud and opportunities for improvement there, as there is in the private sector too. But I think Americans need to be reminded of the many good things that governments, that a functioning government subject to laws and ethics rules actually does, as well as the many bad things that happen when you have a government that is run by a kleptocratic, nepotistic, mm-hmm. just out to enrich itself, and a government that frankly isn't sufficient to function. And I think, you know, we can see so many examples of places like that around the world, and they're not places that a lot of people want to immigrate to. You know, they're just not as pleasant places to live.
Right.
And number three, God, because of course, as we discussed, the most important, I would say, ideological framework for the largest part of this movement is religious nationalism, which is in many instances a way of getting the rank and file to vote a certain way. Like, look, movement leaders know, if you can get people to vote on a single issue, you can control their vote. For two or three issues, you can control their vote. So a large feature of this movement is it's sort of get out the vote machine.
Mm-hmm.
A country where 40 to 50% of people don't vote, and an additional number have their vote sort of downgraded because of race-based gerrymandering or
right.
other voter suppression tactics. You don't need a majority to win elections. What you need is a disproportionately motivated minority. So if you get people to be single-issue abortion voters, a lot of times, you know, the vote for an anti-democratic, transparently amoral leader, it becomes like, that's like a rationalization strategy. Well, he's anti-abortion, he's going to end abortion, and this is the greatest
right.
technology of our time. So
yeah, ignore all the stuff he wants to do to strip away the other rights that I have.
Exactly.
But he's pro-life, and therefore, and the deception there, particularly when it comes to someone like Trump, is that he's not pro-life. Trump has never been pro-life. And so the fact that
he's happy to exploit the people he can exploit. And a lot of his
use your language, but he's not down with your cause. But he knows that you're sucker enough for the language that if he gets up and he uses the words and parrots them in a way that makes you feel good about that his position or what's coming out of his mouth, you ignore all the other stuff, including the fact that his history tells you what he really is versus what he's claiming to be.
He'll also give them, you know, the justices that they want. Like the 2016 election, he had a gathering in New York City with over 1,000 evangelical leaders, and he held up a list of judges like shiny new bonds. And he said, essentially, you know, you do for me and I'll do for you. You get behind me and I'm going to appoint justices from this list, and all these judges are pro-life. So, you know, movement leaders know if they can get the courts, they can get the country. But you got to look deeper at, like, you know, whatever your thoughts are about some of these culture war issues, we have to recognize that they function almost like the laser pointer cat toy. It's like a red dot and the cat jumps at it. That's how they function. You get people looking at this little issue here. And now, by the way, they're not talking as much about abortion. They're talking more about culture war issues that affect such a frankly smaller number of issues, but like they have to do with gender and sexuality, and everybody gets upset about it or looks, right? Because anything having to do with sexuality and gender is very distracting. But they get people to focus on this issue and they're not focusing on the corruption, on economic policies that are actually going to make it harder for families to succeed and not easier.
So let's get into some of the chapters in the book, which, again, very compelling the way you have laid out the various pieces of the money, lies, and God paradigm as sort of the stuff that eats away at the democracy. You start out early in the book talking about the various ways in which individuals and institutions have come together in this unholy alliance, if you will, that eats away at the fabric of democracy. For example, the California Dreaming scenario with Joan Lindsay's organization, the Lindsay Foundation. And then you move into Timothy Bush and Robert Bush and, you know, very super wealthy ultra-conservatives. And don't get me started on the ultra-conservatives who in the Catholic Church who bastardized. Look, I'm an old school Catholic, love the Trinitine Mass and the old traditions. It is a beautiful prayer, but also recognize that, you know, the church ain't doing what it did at the time of Christ, right? So even that evolution, but you still have these folks who are putting their money behind. So talk about some of those pieces, even getting into what you found when you visited Moms for Liberty and all of these various early pieces of the money line part of the story.
Oh, thank you. I mean, thank you so much for, I don't know where to begin. I love that chapter too, because it really shows the split within sort of the Catholic Church and the Catholic laity, where you've got two men whose names happen to be, last name happened to be Bush. They're not related. But one of them is a progressive Catholic who really believes in helping the poor, the least of these. And he's representative of a very large number of Catholics who are very committed to these ideas and principles. Right. And then you have someone else who's another fellow, Timothy Bush, who's like a very extremely wealthy funder. And he's one of the many funders who are kind of trying to drag the church to the right in different ways. But, you know, here's the thing about the funders. I mean, I write about a large number of them in Money, Lies, and God. And I'm thinking of people, not just Bush, but the Corkerys or Barry Side or the Wilkes brothers, Tim Dunn, members of the Ross Prince family. Here's the thing. The funders are not any one type. Some are evangelical. Some are Protestant. Some are Catholic. Some are Jewish. Others are frankly atheistic. I can think of some of the tech bro billionaires now, you know, who seem to believe in nothing more than themselves and money.
So their God is technology.
Exactly. So religiously, these funders are all over the place, but they're all sort of swimming in the same headwaters. And they agree on one thing, which is the need to crush liberalism and what they call the administrative state. They have this idea, they're sort of buying into the idea that they want the economic policies that are going to increase, not just increase their fortunes, but also justify the massive accumulation of sort of monopolistic fortune. And I think, frankly, some of these funders aren't quite as smart as they think they are. They think that somehow investing in the destruction of democracy is going to be good for them, right? But I mean, I think, do they not have children and grandchildren? Do they not paid attention what happens to autocracies? I think they're sort of, in some instances, making the same bad bet that leaders of sort of industrial and industrial leaders, in Nazi Germany made, thinking, well, we'll just get on the side of power. We'll ally ourselves with power and we'll be able to continue with our employment.
They use the money to align with power to hijack the faith traditions, capital T, of these religious institutions, because it's, as we've seen, it's not just the Catholic Church, it is the Baptist Church, which has gone through all kinds of crazy over the last number of years.
All religions are very split. I mean, you know, religion in America is incredibly diverse. So we can't say it's all of the Catholic Church. It's
right.
Within it, yeah.
So it is this dynamic that you see playing out that really, from the money side, sort of feeds some of the activity. The dollars are used to prop up these institutions like an Opus Dei and other organizations that have these, you know, these ideas about their faith that are not aligned necessarily with the way the church, the respective church is moving, because societies evolve. You cannot be stuck in 16th century Roman Catholicism, be in a very pluralistic, diverse culture and society that has to keep in mind that evolution. The church rightly understands that and recognizes the value of certain traditions being timeless, right? But even in those instances, they try to incorporate them, update them to current practices. For example, the only constant is the tradition of the teaching, you know, of that faith. But it is amazing how that gets warped and people reinterpret them in order to gain a political advantage. Right?
This is true.
That's largely how it kind of plays itself out. And so it then finds itself metastasizing into lies, right? About what is and what isn't truth. And so that plays itself out on college campuses. It plays itself out in boards of education, where you go after things like CRT and books that you can't read now because your faith has now been warped to a point where you begin to believe the lies that a book about a young man or a young woman discovering their sexuality is somehow now an abomination against God, et cetera. So it becomes this really interesting dynamic that then the money kind of moves into the lies because the end game is God. You're ultimately going to speak for God. You're ultimately going to reinterpret what God has taught us and is telling us. That's the through line, ultimately.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of these very wealthy people have invested in these massive disinformation or propaganda campaigns that want to make people afraid. They want people to think they're being victimized by a deep state or a woke elite. The idea that any opposition to the MAGA agenda is actually...
Well, that's your chapter on smashing the administrative state, which is Project 2025 and all of the weapons that they want to use coming out of Heritage and the Claremont Review, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, in the book, I pay a lot of attention to a group I call the Thinkers. It's a group of intellectuals affiliated with a movement called the New Right, many of whom have come out of the Claremont Institute or are affiliated with the Claremont Institute and other think tanks like Heritage Foundation. If you look at Project 2025, I think it's got a real, you can see the marriage between the religious right and the new right.
Yeah.
And, you know, technically, I would say the intellectuals on the new right aren't quite what you'd call Christian nationalist, although some are, you know, like Russell Vogt is more, yeah, self-identifies as a Christian nationalist. And he's director of Trump's Office of Management and Budget and was a sort of architect, one of the architects of Project 2025. But other thinkers in this movement, frankly, seem really nihilistic. I mean, some draw inspiration from political theorists associated with the Nazis. I kid you not.
Yeah.
They seem almost more driven by campus politics or political conflicts than anything else. They're always criticizing elites, but they really want to be a new elite. And they really have played a really critical role in bringing funders together with, I would say, the rank and file of the Christian nationalist movement.
So we're having a great conversation with Catherine Stewart. Her new book, Out Money, Lies, and God, is out now, Inside the Movement to Destroy American Democracy. When we come back, we've so far we've covered from the book the funders and a little bit of the thinkers. We want to get into the sergeants, the infantry, and the power players. Because she's laid it out, folks. It's amazing storylines when you see it, especially put together the way Catherine has in her new book, Money, Lies, and God. We're going to get more into it right after this.
Hi, I'm John Fugelsang.
And I'm Professor Corey Brettschneider.
And we are here to tell you about The Oath and the Office, an essential new podcast about the extremely strange times we find ourselves in.
In the first few seconds in office, the President of the United States is required to take an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. And we're going to hold him to that pledge, despite the fact that he has threatened democracy and even the law itself.
It's all about hope for what democracy should look like and getting real about what our democracy does look like from an esteemed constitutional scholar and a deeply unqualified comedian.
Subscribe to The Oath in the Office wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. Catherine Stewart's got the new hit book out here, Money, Lies, and God. It is an incredible inside story about how these elements have come together to really reimagine the American experiment, democracy, in a not really good way. And when we left, we were having a conversation around the funders, the people who kind of put up the big dollars into a lot of these efforts that we're seeing play out in the Trump administration, the thinkers, the guys like Russell Vaught, who, you know, head of OMB now, and the role he played in the creation of Project 2025. Let's talk about the sergeants and the infantry and the power players. Who are in these categories of people and the roles that they play in this effort to undermine our democracy?
Thank you. The infantry is this sort of rank and file that has to be persuaded to vote for the hyper-conservative, or I would say, frankly, radical candidates that the movement favors. I think the word conservative is really should no longer apply because the destruction of democracy and its institutions is not remotely conservative. It's not a conservative project. It's a radical project. But this rank and file really has to be distinguished from the leadership cadre and certainly from the political pastors and national activists, groups that I call the sergeants and the power players who are really driving the agenda. If you're looking for people who are articulating Christian nationalism in its most extreme theocratic form, you're going to find them among the sergeants, these hyper-political pastors who are tasked with turning out their congregations to vote for those far-right candidates.
And there's no shame with these pastors proselytizing political ideology from their pulpits.
No, and frankly, you know, I've been to these pastor gatherings. So a lot of these pastors are drawn into networks like Watchmen on the Wall and Faith Wins and Church United and some pastor networks targeting specific populations. Like there are special Hispanic pastor networks now. If you look at the reason for the shift, the sort of pretty dramatic shift in the Latino vote between 2016 and 2024, I think a large piece of that is due to the pastor networks targeting, with some of them targeting Latino pastors specifically and others just sort of drawing pastors of all sort of ethnic backgrounds into these networks. And they give them the leaders you know, people like, you know, I went to one, it was called Faith Wins. We had Chad Connolly, a leader in the Council for National Policy. We had David Barton and his son, Tim Barton. These are sort of myth makers of the movement. They sort of have crafted this idea that pastors need to be politically engaged. They need to turn out their congregations to vote, and they give them sort of mythological version of American history that's highly partisan to get them to do this. And, you know, a lot of these pastors, honestly, Michael, I've met these, they're not that, a lot of them are really lovely people. You know, one pastor I remember, you know, they're at this gathering and they're distributing these materials that are supposedly being taught in public schools that have to do with like sexuality. And frankly, you know, I did some fact checking and none of the materials were actually being taught in any public school in the manner that it was being suggested. Mm-hmm. And some of the materials were not being taught in any public school. But the pastor was like, we've got to talk about this stuff because they're destroying our families. And, you know, the family is the most valuable thing that we have. So it's like, they too have been subject to these lies.
But that's the thing. You know, it's always kind of ironic to me that the people who protest the most about such things are the ones who have the most to hide. You know, I mean, the sexual abuse scandal in the Catholic Church is not, you know, unique to the Catholic Church.
You know, there's a real scandal in our religious communities. And I think it really shows that, you know, religion can be a marvelous force for good, but it can also be a means of controlling people. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are simply not, you know, walking the walk.
Right, they're not walking that walk that they're talking out there. And so it is amazing to me that, you know, people can have such an absolutist response to all of this. Some of these pastors are like, so what do you do with your gay child? I guess you kind of put them off to a place where you try to get them ungay. You have to send them off to some camp. Some summer camp, thinking that that's going to fix it. Or, you know, what about the pastor that's secretly beating his wife or his children? What about, you know, the family that is dealing with members who are, you know, in crime syndicates and behaving in criminal ways? I mean, in other words, we're all humans. And this is the thing that drives me nuts with certain pastors on this hard right Christian, and I'll throw the word white in, you know, sort of nationalism, is it is so disconnected from the gospel, because the one thing Christ recognized out of the gate was y'all messed up. Y'all got issues.
Abuse of power.
Abuse of power. I mean, that was why he went off against the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the people who held the traditions of the Torah over the Jews in such a way that, you know, you couldn't have, you know, this, do this on that day, and you can't, you know, be in this space at that time. And Christ was like, but do you love each other? I know you can't eat pork, but do you love your fellow man and woman? The woman at the well, the woman who's about to be stoned in each moment, Christ is like, okay, y'all who don't have sin, y'all go ahead and do it. Do it, right? And everybody kind of put down the rocks and walk away, because then you realize your humanity. You are not in a position to judge. And yet these people sit in judgment over our lives and use that frailty, that humanity, against us.
Yeah, listen, it's very authoritarian, you know, it's a very authoritarian movement. And, you know, this idea that you really can't question the, you know, the those who say, you know, we're in a war against demonic forces, and therefore we need to smash up our democracy and simply destroy it. And you get a lot of the people, the sort of power players, who are the sort of leaders of, you know, the organizations, the key organizations of the religious right, and the sort of movement leaders who are, listen, we don't know what's in people's hearts, right? We don't know to what degree they are simply after power for themselves, or to what degree they actually believe in what they're saying. I think, but two things can be true at once. Like this movement, the folks in it really operate within an information bubble. They're saying this stuff that they're hearing all day long. They're repeating it back to one another. And so I think that two things can be true. I think they can really think they're doing what God wants them to do and justify that in their minds as they're sort of accumulating power for themselves and for their political allies.
What is it about the desperation of individuals and mankind, as you look at the arc of history, that allows this, the emergence of power players and funders to create an infantry, to put in place sergeants, and all of that is justified and solidified by the thinkers, the so-called smart people. When we think about, you know, all the people who have all these degrees are the ones who
institutions. I know. And they're going after saying, oh, education is so terrible. And yet they have
you're just sitting there with a Yale law degree and education is so terrible. What are you saying, Josh Hawley? What are you saying, you know, Ted Cruz, when you are the product, J.D. Vance, you know, he of hillbilly elegy fame, you know, with all of the trappings of a better education than most of the people in the community of Appalachia, where he comes from. And turn that against the people. What was that?
Funded by, you know, Peter Thiel, one of the richest men in America. Power. It's power. You know, people want it and it corrupts absolutely. It's really tragic that these folks are really trying to destroy the democracy that has, for all of its imperfections, beautiful ideals. It has served as the engine of economic prosperity. It's, you know, obviously imperfectly, but ensured a certain kind of post-war stability, nuclear non-proliferation in many regards. We've had alliances that have been very fruitful. But, you know, here's the thing about like the attack on education. Movement leaders understand that an educated populace is antithetical to their aims. They see the truth as their enemy.
Well, that's an understatement, given what we've been through with Trump and his lies for the last 10 years. It really kind of levels up for folks that there's still a higher degree of gullibility to a lot of the lies. And you know that when they have to frame the truth as fake news. And you know that when they have to reframe the truth tellers as traitors, and which really kind of makes you scratch your head when you stop and you think about January 6th and how you recast the people who are trying to overthrow the government as patriots, when your eyes and your instincts and your gut tell you what you just witnessed was not patriotic at all.
No, it was an absolute disgrace. And yet Trump, one of the first things he did was pardon them, basically sending the message that they can act outside the bounds of the law. And if as long as it's, you know, on his behalf, he will be absolutely fine with it. And that's incredibly dangerous. But, you know, listen, this is a movement that is, I think we can't talk about the crisis that we're in normal terms. This is not just about the give and take in an ordinary election, in an ordinary political environment where you have people who want one thing and people who maybe want the same thing but have another way to go about it. We have one movement that's hell-bent on absolutely smashing up our democracy, and they're succeeding. I mean, look at this whole disgraceful thing about this Signal group that, for instance, Hegseth and his buddies we're discussing.
And so just to set for folks, you had the Department of Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, create a group chat on Signal to discuss the bombing of Yemen. And on that chat, he puts Jonah Goldberg, a reporter, who was sitting there going, this has got to be a joke, right?
But, you know, this is more than just about incompetence. It's about an administration that has contempt for the law, contempt for democracy. So a proper and responsible government would make sure that they follow the processes lawfully prescribed, that make sure their actions are recorded kept properly secret and are there for the record. But basically, by doing this over Signal, which is a commercial private network that's really only secure for some people, and by sort of shambolically including a journalist, they're basically saying, oh, first of all, doing it over a Signal means that they don't want a record of the decisions they're making. They don't think they need to follow the rules that apply.
Right.
It's like total contempt for the processes that have been put in place over time to keep our country safe. They do it wantonly because they have no respect for the law. And, you know, by the way, if you want to run a government for graft and corruption, frankly, this is how you do it. You do it over a Signal chat and then you delete the chat. So there's never going to be a record and nobody's accountable. So, you know, there's that. I mean, it's just contempt for the whole project of democracy. They're really abusing the system under which they themselves have flourished.
And I want to correct myself, it's Jeffrey Goldberg, not Jonah. I know we all know Jonah Goldberg, but Jeffrey Goldberg from The Atlantic was the one who was placed on that Signal thread. And everyone should read that, by the way, just because it really does reinforce what Catherine just said about how they look at things. And you can, if you take what she just said and you apply it to what you're reading, yeah, you're going to walk away from that very concerned. You had the great, or I guess fortuitous, luck of having your book, Money, Lies, and God, come out the week after the inauguration. How has that been to see what's happened since then in the context of what you wrote? Because you began writing this book before all of this really kind of came together the way it did. I mean, this was not something that you put together between September of 2024 and January of 25. So you have been in this space for a little while writing this, but then to have in the last 50 to 60 days, these storylines evolve that are literally taken from the pages of your book.
Yeah, I've been following this movement for 16 years, and Money, Lies, and God is my third book on the topic. My earlier books, The Good News Club and The Power Worshippers Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism, are also about different features of this movement. And, you know, I've always thought you can't really know what's happening unless you're in the room. You've got to hear people when they're talking to one another, movement leaders, because it's a leadership-driven movement. That was obvious to me from the start. It's leadership-driven, organization-driven. You have to go into those places where they're saying what they're going to do. And I don't have any secret tricks. I just sign up and go the way you could go, Michael.
Yeah. Well, if I go, I think...
You have, I'm sure, I've been to some of these.
There ain't going to be a whole lot of brothers walking those halls. So if I show up, it's going to be, oh, he here.
Or they'd be like, oh, it's so great to see you. Like, finally.
Yeah, right.
You know, they'd be like, they love the representative. So they
and can. Then my brain would go, run!
Well, I mean, the thing is, they've not been hiding. They've been telling us that what they're going to do for years. They're not hiding. It's that a lot of folks just have
What does that tell you, though? What does that tell you, Catherine? Given the fact that you've been covering these efforts and this movement for as long as you have, that they're pretty arrogant about this. They're pretty like, yeah, okay, try and stop us.
Yeah, well, they've been investing in the infrastructure of their movement for five plus decades. And
true.
The reason for the strength of the movement is because of that deeply networked organizational infrastructure. It's like they, you know, I think a lot of people who are not sort of who are outside of the movement dismissed it for a long time and foolishly just laughed it off. I remember, who was it? It was George Bush's, W. Bush's speechwriter who said, this is a movement that could fit into a phone booth.
Yeah.
He should have known better. They had policy groups, they had legal advocacy sphere that they were building up and they were always already getting big wins in. They had networking groups that get members of the leadership on the same page. They have a messaging sphere that they were developing. They had, oh my gosh, I mean, data initiatives that they were developing.
Well, I mean, what you're saying is so, so accurate and so true on both fronts. The effort that was undertaken across the decades and the response to that effort by the establishment in the Republican Party. I just know sitting at the RNC, my very first meeting with the Tea Party elements, which again was a forward-facing response, while there was an underlying effort that systematically was targeting races for elected officers. But what they missed was the inside game to take control of the party.
Yeah.
Because shortly after they booted me out, literally by the time Reince Priebus became chairman, I mean, in his second term, they had begun the effort to take out the party leadership that would control the apparatus of the party in such a way that touched on the money, the messaging, and the infrastructure for presidential races, Senate races, et cetera.
That's true. I mean, I think for a long time, a lot of Republican leadership thought we can make great use of this movement and this cohort because where else are they going to go? Who else are they going to vote for? They're going to vote for us. So we got...
I told them that wasn't going to work.
Right.
And this was not that crowd.
Now the guardrails have fallen off. Yeah. And now the movement controls the party. Absolutely. And unfortunately, we're seeing where Republican leaders are all getting in line. I mean, you hear about threats and people are afraid. So it's a very challenging situation right now.
So before I let you roll out of here, let's sort of sum up, if we can, the book with this question, because I think it's goes to the heart of what you're writing and what your concern is. Have Americans turned against democracy?
Well, I think a lot of Americans, I think it's too simple a question. I think a lot of Americans don't understand what democracy is and what it does for them.
Because that's the heart of it.
Yeah.
That's the heart right there.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that, you know, a lot of Americans, you know, vote for, you know, who say they're voting for, you know, the lowered price of eggs and lowered price of goods and services, et cetera, are going to be like, are they going to be better off when needless trade wars drive up the price of good and services? Are they going to be better off when family planning becomes so much more difficult so they can't make the most impactful and intimate decisions about their families? Are they going to be better off when rights for the workforce are eroded and even more money accrues to the tippy top of the economic ladder and further sort of thins out
middle class.
Yeah. The middle class? Are they going to be better then? Are they going to be better when we've been abandoned by our closest overseas alliances? Are they going to be better off when their public schools are shuttered or degraded even further? I think that we do have an opportunity in these moments to say to people, here are the people doing this to you, and here are these other folks who are fighting for you. But we have to help people understand the benefit. You know, when Social Security gets decimated, when Medicare gets decimated, when people who are in this country legally and have families and are hard workers, when they're deported for, I don't know, when, you know, the deportations we're starting to see are not. Right. And there was one guy, MAGA supporter, whose wife was deported and he was just kind of shocked. I mean, things like this are going to happen. So, or when industries are decimated because there's people who actually work in those industries, the agriculture industries, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. And those, or construction industries, when those industries are decimated. We just really have an opportunity to try and communicate to people what a functioning democracy governed by rules, law.
Who does that? Because the people you would expect to do it, either if they're Democratic members of Congress, they have no clue how to do it. They clearly show they can't message themselves out of the opened end of a can. And Republicans don't give a damn anymore. In fact, they're embracing this totalitarian, authoritarian, Hungarian kind of meme-based government because for them, it's about the power. It's not about anything else other than having the power and owning the libs, whoever that happens to be.
I think ordinary American citizens, you know, listen, the radical right did not wait for the Republican Party to do what they wanted. They formed organizations apart from the Republican Party, and they eventually took it over. And I think that more Americans would prefer to live in a democracy if they fully understood what it delivers, than a kleptocratic autocracy with authoritarian and theocratic features. So I think that ordinary, you know, I think it really starts with helping people understand what's at stake. We all have spheres of influence. We all have the ability to communicate to our friends, to our faith communities, if we have them, to school communities, if we're part of them, and to people in our circles. I think that, you know, there's no substitute for the vote. The right, when, you know, they lost in 2020, they didn't roll over and suck their thumbs.
Right.
They did things we would never want to do, like spread lies and incite political violence at the Capitol. We wouldn't want to do that. But they also got out their base and they went after low propensity voters, you know? And I think that there's no substitute for turning out the vote. I think on the sort of other side of the political aisle, there's always a lot of talk about how do we flip the MAGA support. Mm-hmm. Very difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, but maybe some of that energy could be better spent rather than, I mean, it's always worth having the conversation. We all have had, I don't know about you, but we've certainly had interesting family holiday Thanksgiving.
Oh, and, yeah, it's fun.
You know, maybe some of that energy would really be well placed, you know, helping reach people who don't understand why their vote matters, who are a little bit disaffected. Like, that's really important to do. And then local activism really matters. I mean, so much of this is really important at the local level. So it's, if you don't show up at your school board meeting, guess who's going to show up? Moms for Liberty.
Right.
Engage on a local level.
They're going to put in the time.
And then, of course, to support democracy building institutions where you can find them.
Yeah. Well, you have written an incredibly important narrative, and it is part of, and you can see it, folks, from the other books that Catherine mentioned, part of this ongoing story that connects a lot of dots that I think, you know, our political class and certainly our media class have ignored or haven't figured out exactly what they mean. You clarify for us who the actors are and where the money comes from, how it's spread around, how it's tied into theologies and ideologies about this country. And it's a great read. Money, Lies, and God: Inside the Movement to Destroy American Democracy by Catherine Stewart. Thank you so much, Catherine, for the conversation.
Thank you. It's great to chat with you today.
Absolutely. Really, really appreciate it. Folks, I hope you appreciate it too, spending some time with Catherine in her book. Please check it out. Follow her on Twitter, X at Kath S. Stewart. That's K-A-T-H-S Stewart. Check out the new book again, Money, Lies, and God. It's available. It's out now. Grab a copy, sit down, and prime yourself for the summer. I would recommend you have an adult beverage when you read it, because there's some chapters you're going to need it, right? Just trust me on that one. Folks, it is a great opportunity for you to learn a little bit more and get some insights of what's happening out there every day in the news. Be a part of the story. As Catherine just indicated, there are ways in which we as citizens can grab control of this. Remember three words, most powerful in our Constitution: we the people. Not complicated. Keep it real and keep it safe out there. Till next time, follow us on Twitter for sure. Love it when you do the downloads that you do. Follow us on Blue Sky. The Bulwark Podcast platform is such a great home for us. Really appreciate it. Until next time, be safe and don't be stupid by following. Stupid. Okay? Just don't do it. It's not worth it.